This podcast is in association with In the Moment magazine, mindful ways to live your life well. On sale now in Waitrose, WH Smith and Sainsbury's. Today on Radio Gorgeous, we have writer Natalie Liu, who is a podcaster, self-publisher, mama and general badass. The theme of our discussion today is core values and how knowing your core values will help you find the right partner. We all want that, amongst other things. So, Natalie, a very warm welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Can you explain what core values are?
Core values are the things that we need in order to live our lives happily and authentically. It all sort of boils down. They're about our preferences, priorities, and our principles. And so if we take care of ourselves in terms of all of these particular areas, then we know that we're going to be happy. We know we're going to be authentic. And so in terms of core values, that covers our character. So the values that speak for who we are as a person, as well as our direction. So the things that are really important to us that really guide where we want to go in life. So that might be our family values, relationship values. You know, do we want to be in a monogamous relationship? Do we want to be sort of free and easy? Do we want to have kids? Political values do come into it ever more so these days. It could be our social values, you know, around, you know, the way we feel about community, you know, our sort of sense of justice, our financial values. And of course, actually, even sexual values as well, because, for instance, you have a partner who has pretty different sexual values to you. No matter how much you love and like that person, you're going to find that you're going in two totally different directions. And actually, that's really what happens with core values. If you don't honor them, you will find that you are in situations that really render it incompatible.
Where do we get our core values from, do you think? And how can we know that they're real? Because someone might have projected core values onto you. Do you see what I
mean? Oh my gosh, like totally. Because yeah. The thing that I always say is that adulthood is about unlearning all of the unproductive and downright harmful stuff that you've picked up along the way. And so nobody hands us a manual at 18 years old and goes, right, there you go, there's all your values. This is what you need to do. This is who you need to hang out with. This is how trust works. No, we have to figure it out for ourselves. And so we start adulthood often with what we've picked up from our family, because obviously that's who we spent likely the most amount of time around. Some maybe from our peers, if we spend a lot of time in church, depending on what we've read or observed on TV. So for instance, I learned a lot about relationships from Dallas and Dynasty and Falcon Crest. You know, inappropriate TV watching for children, but that's where I learned a lot about my relationship values. And so we get to adulthood, and adulthood allows us to put all of our assumptions about what we think we need, what we think is important to us, to the test. And then we discover actually who we are by discovering who we're not. So the bulk of our values are most definitely going to come from our family, I think.
Okay. So you found when you're younger, tell us about dating and the men you looked for and why it didn't work.
Well, I came from a background where, let's just say, relationships weren't exactly my family's strong suit. You know, commitment, not a big thing in my family. You know, sticking together. You know, my mom and my stepfather behaved like Ike and Tina Turner at times. So they were not exactly a template for relationships. So I was a heavy reader as a child. I watched a lot of TV. I'm obviously observing a lot around me. So I rock up to, well, my teenage years and into adulthood, and I'm like, okay, I want to be in a relationship. I think I should basically find somebody who I'm attracted to, and then everything else will sort itself out.
Sounds a good plan, yeah.
Yeah.
Find your prince.
Yes, yeah. And actually that was a lot of it. And so I would tend to look for somebody who was tall, preferably 6 foot to 6 foot four, but definitely above 5'10". And I realized in hindsight it's because my father was about 5'7", so I clearly had a negative association with short men. And they had to have a good sense of humor. I think that was a thing that I used to see in the personal ads as a kid, you know, G-S-O-H. So I was always like, oh yeah, it must make me laugh, because that's clearly like a thing that people need. And they had to be intelligent, because I don't know, my mom would always go on about that. They had to have a good job, ideally a steady job, but it didn't have to be an amazing job. And they could be good looking, but not too good looking, because I thought you'd have more competitors if they're like super good looking. they needed to give me butterflies. So, you know, that kind of butterfly sensation in your stomach. That was pretty much the length and breadth of what I looked for.
To be honest, he sounds absolutely gorgeous.
And, you know, I went out with some pretty, you know, decent looking guys and some quirky looking ones as well. And, you know, on paper, that actually sounds pretty great. Problem is, actually, that none of these things that I found attractive in a partner had anything to do with the ability for my emotional needs to be met or with compatibility. And so I was assuming that, you know, you fall for somebody and then it's like, well, I want a relationship and we're in love and it should work. And what I found was that I consistently found myself with emotionally unavailable men. And so men who were unable to connect really with their emotions, who avoided them, they blew hot and cold, they wanted things on their terms, often reminded me somewhat of my father and even to an extent my mom and my stepfather. And sometimes, yeah, I went out with narcissists as well. So very charming guys who kind of blew in, swept me off my feet, charmed the hell out of me, and then they were gone. I was like, what the hell is going on? And really what it was is the way we treat values really gives a bit of an indication, in fact, a lot of an indication about the way that we feel about ourselves. I realized that I really only had superficial knowledge of myself. I only liked myself superficially. You know, I spent a fortune on clothes and shoes and handbags and looking good back in those days. But I didn't care about who I was as a person, what mattered in a relationship, because I didn't have a clue what the hell to look for. And so it got me into an awful lot of trouble. So I've been out with some very hot, unavailable men and some very charming, unavailable men. So there was that consistent theme. It was really only when I started to know, like, and trust myself when I started to realize, oh, hold on a second, there's a lot more to a relationship than what I used to think it was all about.
What was the turning point for you, Natalie?
I think the turning point, it was the summer of 2005. I had been seeing a guy for about 5 months and it had started off the usual, hot out the gate. He was calling me, emailing me, texting me, wanted to be around me all the time. That was about the first 2-3 weeks. After that, it went into a slow canter and I had no clue what was going on. I had also, just before I met him, like a few months before I met him, I had been involved in an affair with a guy at work.
Wow.
And if anybody had said to me...
Secret from everyone at work?
Mostly, yeah. I mean, I think some people have figured it out, but it was mostly a secret. And if somebody had said to me, even 2 years before, oh, you would get involved with a guy or a girlfriend, I'd be like, are you out of your mind? I would never do that. And yet there I was. And so much about my life at that particular point was all this stuff that I definitely would not have said was about me. I was putting up with stuff I didn't want to put up with. You know, I was finding myself in, you know, shady relationship or certainly unavailable one after unavailable one. I realized it was just after my 28th birthday and I'd had an immune system disease for a couple of years at that point. And basically they told me that it was incurable and that, you know, if I didn't go on steroids for life, I was going to basically sort of be dead by the age of 40, but from, you know, pulmonary heart failure or something like that.
Terrifying.
Well, it was. It was, I sat there and it was this very, very surreal moment. I was sat in this consultant's office and it was in the lung clinic at a North Middlesex hospital. And if you've ever been in a lung clinic, there's a lot of obviously cancer patients.
And old man coughing.
Yeah. And so this is where I used
to
go.
Young.
Yeah, I was young. I was like, I'd just turned 28. And I was going for a good sort of year, 18 months, I was going to North Middlesex Hospital. Like every sort of few weeks, I was having blood tests. I was having breathing tests. I was having scans for this and scans for that. And, you know, I just left it all in their hands. They said, take steroids for a year. I took steroids for the year. I came off them for a bit. And then all of a sudden, I found myself with this man telling me, you know, it can't be cured. We don't know why you have it. We don't know what's caused it. We don't know how to get rid of it. Take these steroids. And I was like, I heard myself. No. And he went, what? And I was like, no, I can't do that. And he was like, don't you understand? There is no cure. This is all you can do. And I went, I need to go out and look at my other options. Obviously, if my symptoms get worse in that time, I will come back to you. I'm not reckless, but I need to explore my other options. If you don't even know why the hell I have this or, you know, how to cure it, what's to stop me from going around and looking at my other options? And I came out of there and suddenly I thought, Natalie, like, what the hell are you doing with your life? Like, how have you got to this point where you've just moseyed along? You're so busy chasing guys and, you know, chasing anything that you haven't really thought about yourself, and you just let this house situation just like arrive on you. And suddenly I started to fight back. And as part of sort of taking care of myself, you know, I went to see this kinesiologist, like acupuncture without needles. You know, she was saying, right, I thought I was going for nutrition. She started to talk to me about my emotions and stuff. And I was going, I didn't come here for that type of thing. But by the time I left that first session with her, I was like, oh my God, like I've got a whole load of emotional trauma from childhood that is driving my whole life. And I've been making these choices, and I don't want to be dead by the time, I don't know, I don't want to be dead by the time I'm 40. I want to have kids. I want to do stuff. And so I made this commitment to myself that I was going to take care of my health, but I was going to start learning how to set some boundaries. And I was going to start really conducting myself in a way that represented the types of relationship I wanted to have. I don't know where this is coming from. She didn't say half this stuff to me. I just suddenly thought, I've got to do something. It was, in a way, some of it was quite intuitive. And so I started basically thinking about, like, how do I want to feel? What, you know, is this, is the way that I want to feel, is that what my work reflects? Is this the way that I want to be in relationships? It was an eye-opener immediately. Family in particular were quite an eye-opener.
They put you in a role, don't they?
Oh, totally. They box you in. And actually,
what was your role then?
I have been scapegoat, black sheep, peacemaker, and the over-responsible one. So
wow, that's a real diverse mixture.
Yeah, well, yeah. When you have parents that are not too hot on responsibility and you're the oldest...
Okay.
You...
So you're a bit like Safi out of AbFab.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. Funny enough, one of the things that I talk to people a lot about is this question of roles, because it has a huge part to play in core values. Because what happens is that we all slip into roles as part of being in a family. There's this family dynamic, and somebody, you know, might be, you know, the under-responsible one.
Yep.
Somebody else might be the overachiever.
Yeah, it's very interesting, because at breakfast today, my daughter said to my partner, what's it like having three children? And he looked quizzed and he said, don't you realise mummy's like a child? Now, I take that as a real compliment.
Yeah. It's like, look at that youthful spirit. Your inner child is
exactly.
Free.
But he sees it as, oh my God, I'm the responsible one. You know, so it's very interesting what you said. Anyway, carry on.
Yeah, so we take on these roles, and these roles that we either assume in childhood or that we almost see as being put upon us sometimes.
Yes.
We see that as our function, like our job within a family. Now, that's part of our survival mechanism for growing up. But where we run into problems is we take that and we use it as, oh, this is the way that I have to be, full stop. Like, this is how I have to be in the world, which is why I hear from so many people who are near losing their minds at work, because all those roles that they have taken on in childhood, they're just playing that same role at work, and they feel put upon. They feel taken advantage of. They feel like, oh, I'm the odd one out, because, of course, if you're used to being the black sheep at home, then somehow you find yourself being the black sheep at work, or, you know, in your friendship group. And these roles, actually, it's really important as part of owning our core values that we really start asking ourselves, what is actually true and right for me? It's like, it's not about going, oh, let's throw the baby out with the bathwater and be like, oh, well, I picked up all these values from my family, so they're all useless.
Yeah, I can do what the hell I like.
Yeah. It's not about that. It's going, okay, so I'm telling myself I must do this and I should do this. Why? Like, where did that come from? Like, who told you that? When you start to ask these questions, you go, oh, like, my mom said that, or father, whoever said that at church. Okay, but what's true and right for you? Like, what do you want to do? Because roles, and really anything that doesn't have anything whatsoever to do with core values, is going to be about obligation. So telling ourselves, I must and I should do this stuff. But it is also, as well, I think, going to be about programming instead of preference. So look at, like, what are you doing automatically? And it's one thing if what you do
unconsciously.
And it's one thing if what you do, for instance, might just come down to brushing your teeth each day, you know, morning and night. That's great. But if what you do automatically is really about ignoring your core values, always chasing after, like, the high of feelings, you know, where's that taking you? I'll say to people, what are you looking for in a partner? I hear about beards. It's really important to have a beard or no beard. I hear about, I like them really tall, or I can only be with this type, or they need to have this education level, or they need to have this salary. They must be like really, really intelligent. And I go, okay, there's nothing wrong per se. It's not even about wrong. There's nothing wrong with us liking these things about people, but it's the assumptions that we make about it. And it tells us a few things. These are things that we either overvalue in ourselves, often to the detriment of our character. So we ignore actually truly valuable things about us, what we bring into the world. But it also tells us sometimes about what we think we need from somebody else to make us like whole and a better person.
Totally agree with that.
To make us really attractive.
Yeah.
Hence why I hear from so many people who are drawn to charming people and popular people and people who have status. And it's a part of us. We're trying to meet unmet needs from childhood. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that we're not kids anymore. We have an inner child that we can take care of. But the way to do that isn't to basically keep putting ourselves in the past. And so I say to people, great that you like these things, but do you realize that not one thing you're talking about has anything to do with compatibility or the ability for your emotional needs to be met? And their mouths fall open and they go, oh, like it has literally never occurred. They've assumed that the reason why, and I often use this example, just because you like hip hop and skiing and 18th century poetry and fine wine does not mean that somebody else who literally likes those same four things is exactly the same as you. There could be a serial killer in prison who likes those same four things as you. And so one of the things as humans that we're guilty of is assuming that the reason why we have a particular taste is to do with our character. Like, oh, I like skiing because, you know, I'm this type of person.
I'm sophisticated.
Yeah. And actually, it's very possible that somebody who you think I wouldn't talk to them if they were the last person on earth, they might actually like skiing too. And it's got nothing whatsoever to do with their character.
You judge them also on their looks, on, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. We make these snap judgments. Like somebody said to me last week, well, I like what I like. So how am I supposed to make myself attracted to somebody else? And I said, well, it's not about making yourself attracted to somebody else. It's about realizing your blind spots. It's fine for you to like what you like. But at the moment that you like that, it's going, oh my gosh, must be grounded and actually get to know the person.
Okay, so we find out our core values. How quickly can we find out this?
Somebody else's? Yeah. That's always the one of it. I always say that when we are first getting to know somebody, you know, Chris Rock, the comedian, I think it's in his early stand-up show, Bigger and Blacker, he talks about how when we first start going out with somebody, we're not meeting them, we're meeting their representative.
Totally.
So they're wearing their best, you know, we're wearing our best drawers, you know, bringing our A game, we're funny, you know, we're hitting out the ballpark.
Yeah.
It's not that we're not these things.
That's what especially males are like. We know in company they are so amazing and the funniest storytellers and everything.
Yeah.
And in private they're like, get me a cup of tea.
Yeah, roll over, fart. Yeah. And so people make the mistake of assuming I met this person, it's charming, amazing. And it's like they take a photograph on day zero, day one.
For Instagram, of course.
And they assume, oh, this is what I'm going to get from this person. So I say to people, that period of time when you're dating, when you're not even yet in a relationship, you're only getting to know the surface of that person. At that particular point, the only real things that you're going to pick up are some surface indications about what their core values might be. And you can weed out, though, at this point, based on inappropriateness more so than you can on, are we compatible to be together forever and evermore? Mm. So that means that never ignore what is known as red flag behavior in the early stages. It's like, if you ignore that, you know, if you ignore yourself at these early stages, you are already running into problems because you already know that
you're
already
compromising.
Exactly. Yeah. And so in the early stages, you know, I've been out with some guys who literally the first time I met them, they were behaving like a jackass. And I remember going,
what kind of showing off?
I remember one particular guy, I observed him in a bar and he
observed
was
being, him. Yeah. Like he's an animal.
Yeah. In the wild.
Got your binoculars out.
Yeah. And he was so arrogant and rude, not just to the staff, but to another guy that was there. Do you know, I went out with him for 6 months. And that same behavior that I observed in him on that very, very first night is behavior that showed itself much further on in the relationship and was a real problem. And I say to people, if you ignore something, it will come back to bite you so big further down. So it's best not to ignore and go, oh, my future self will deal with it.
Because don't you quite often find the things that you're attracted to a person for are the things that you hate when you, you know what I mean? When you start falling out.
Totally. Yeah. Totally. And it's like, oh, yeah, it's really, really important. Oh, like, I'm just totally attracted because they're hilarious. Yeah, they're really hilarious when they basically keep, you know, making jokes about you and laughing at you and, you know, and all that. And it's not that the things that we like about people that we should forget about those, but it's more that if we truly do want to be around people with whom we have compatibility, we have to be willing to have good boundaries and recognize when things don't feel right. Then we can weed out on that basis. When we proceed forward, then that's when the proper getting to know happens. You know, like you go for a job interview, everybody knows when the boss talks about what the job is going to be like, you don't know what the job is really going to be like until you actually do the job. It's the same with relationships. Like, you can't expect to basically find out everything before you get into a relationship and then everything's going to be just as they, you know, portrayed it then. The real getting to know begins when you both say, okay, yeah, we're going to be in a relationship together. And then things start to unfold from there. And that's when you start to notice, you know, can we both say no in this relationship? Can, you know, can we both have healthy boundaries? Am I willing to actually be that much more honest with this person? Like, am I willing to go to that level in terms of intimacy? You know, how does this person respond to stress? How does this person respond to conflict and criticism? You know, what happens if they don't get their own way? All these types of things. When they talk about, oh, I'm like really honest, because you know, there's some people that are real like, tell, don't show. Yeah. And so they'll be like, oh, I like, I'm such an honest person. How are they actually, you know, embodying that honesty, you know, within the relationship with you? Do you see them do that with others as well? And so it's noticing, like, all those things that you say are really important to you in a relationship. For instance, you know, I talk about love, care, trust, and respect. How is that person embodying them? And how are you embodying that in a relationship as well?
Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous and telling us all about core values and how to have boundaries in relationships, Natalie.
My pleasure.
To read more about the issues we've talked about today, go to the 8th edition of In the Moment magazine. It's on sale now in Waitrose, WH Smith and Sainsbury's. This podcast was produced by RadioGorgeous.com 2018.